Once I get my natural Harvey Fierstein.
I saw Greg.
Did we ever have a joke about how like you go Harvey Fierstein and I go Fran Drescher when I have laryngitis? I feel like that was a thing because I have gone. I've
what
gone
a combo.
Fran Drescher before.
What a combo!
Yeah.
I Instagram showed me on my algorithm a pretty great clip of Harvey Fierstein being interviewed by Barbara Walters.
I've seen that one before,
and
yeah.
He makes like very good points, but it was just fascinating. First of all, I feel like every clip I ever see of Barbara Walters cements this idea that she was actually a pretty shitty interviewer. She does just ask this entirely wild question of like, what's it like to be gay? And it's like,
yeah.
You're a journalist?
Right.
Yeah, that is a crazy question. Like, what does that mean?
He handles it really beautifully.
He does, yeah.
And he doesn't really let her off the hook. He's actually very clear of like, here's why that's an offensive question, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
And he kind of turns it around on her. But I think about that all the time of just like, why were you like such a major interviewer for
I mean,
long?
I don't know. Is it just time? Like, are we just sort of overestimating where we were back then? That like
maybe.
That was the question people thought. Like they just thought like that question assumes that you know what it's like to be any other way.
Right.
So it could be born of this idea that like you weren't always gay.
Right.
Right. Which was a thing people used to think. And some still do, I'm sure.
There's many other examples throughout a long span of time that show what a shit. Like when she interviewed Britney Spears, she basically calls her a slut. To her
right,
face.
I remember that.
It's
yeah.
really wild, the stuff she got away with.
Is it just because she was like polite and demure? Very,
yeah,
demure,
yeah,
very,
very
demure, very mindful.
Very mindful.
She was keeping it demure.
Welcome to another episode of Why Did We Watch This, the podcast where three friends sit down, watch a nice movie, watch a bad movie, have
watch a nice movie. We watch a nice movie.
Sometimes we watch a nice
Sometimes.
Movie. Sometimes. We watch a bad movie, we have a nice drink, we talk about why it was bad and how we can make it so much better. I am your host this week, Lee Delahanty.
I'm Chris Ravel.
And I am Brendan Drischler.
And this will be one of our mini episodes where we'll introduce the movie we're doing in 2 weeks and then have a little chat and go over what we'll have for a drink. So in 2 weeks, we will be doing 2003's The Singing Detective. This is directed by Keith Gordon.
Of all people.
A whole bunch of people. We got Robert Downey Jr. We got Mel Gibson, Robin Wright Penn,
Robin
Jeremy
Wright,
Northam.
Yeah. She's just Robin Wright now.
She's just Robin, yeah.
She
Robin
dropped
Wright,
the pen.
Okay.
Yeah,
like
sure did.
A student fumbling at school, she dropped that pen.
Yeah. Oh, this must show who she was credited as at the time.
I'm sure she would have been at the time. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, it's a wild movie that we're kicking off our summer of insane musicals.
Yeah,
with.
Summer of unhinged musicals. It's our theme for this summer. Three unhinged musicals coming to you hot.
Yeah.
And I'm confident that while each of our unhinged musical choices are, they're all unhinged. They're unhinged in their own special different
yes.
ways.
Yes, everything is unhinged in its own way. So hold on to your doors, fellows, because by the time this summer is over, there will be no hinges to be found.
Yeah. Now, this movie, we'll talk about it in 2 weeks in more detail, is, of course, also adapted from a quite renowned BBC television show. From like the 80s or 70s.
80s, yeah.
80s. And also that was adapted from a book. So it's got a long storied history.
Yeah, I will be interested in looking up some more information about like the whole production process of this movie, because it's a strange one in that sense. So
suffice
at the very
to
least,
say, I don't think this is like the best version of it.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine most people would say the miniseries, which already exists, is the best version of it.
Yeah.
But here we are.
Yeah. Anyway, we'll need a drink, of course, to get through this movie. So what will we be drinking?
The drink we'll be making for The Singing Detective is called the Heartbreak of Psoriasis. It is 1.5 ounces of whiskey, 1/2 ounce of Aperol, 1/2 ounce of honey syrup, 1/2 ounce of lemon juice, mint leaves, and tobacco bitters. You add the whiskey, the Aperol, the honey syrup, lemon juice, and a few dashes of tobacco bitters into a cocktail shaker. Add the mint leaves and muddle until the oils have been released. Add ice to the cocktail shaker and shake multiple times. Then you strain the contents into a glass over ice. Garnish it with some mint leaves.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good.
I'm ready. That sounds incredibly good. Refreshing.
Yeah, it does.
Delicious.
Especially with summer.
Like summer. Yeah.
Just like
very
descending
much so.
On us.
Yeah, I think I'm in a very pro Aperol state right now, frankly, too.
Yeah. Well, obviously, you can come back at us in 2 weeks if you just want to check out our episode on The Sing Detective. For our mini topic this week, we didn't have one.
No,
so
we thought and nothing came.
There's no, you know, sometimes the time to record happens before the idea for the mini.
Right. Sometimes we just got nothing suggested by the movie. It's just there's nothing in the news that's interesting to chat about.
I mean, but you know, we did decide we'll just have a little, we've done, I think, stuff like this before on occasion, just some little informal, little round robin style check-ins on what we're all doing at the moment, media wise. What are you reading? What are you listening to? What are you playing? What are you looking at on a screen?
What are you staring at?
What are you staring at?
Are those feet pics?
What's on good screen?
Yes, Chris, I can see feet pics reflected in your glasses.
Look at all the feet pics. Yeah. No, so I have your screen over here, and then over here I just had an open Google Doc where
I wasn't literally suggesting that you were looking at feet pics.
Oh no, of course not. But I really do have a Google Doc open with my like scattered thoughts I'm going to use.
Yeah.
That's good.
So yeah, does anyone want to open us up, Chris?
I'm going to open up because
baby's sick.
Yeah, my customary travel cold or some like that. Who the fuck knows? Anyway,
no, that's a thing. It's a real thing.
No, I know it is. I'm just Rich didn't get it. I did. I was fine for the whole trip up until we got back. Who the fuck knows? Anyway,
so
I don't really have a whole lot to talk about just because one of the things I was reading a lot of when I was in Italy is going to come into play for later in the summer. But The thing that I wanted to just sort of bring up very quickly before I flounce is which a movie that I assume you guys have both seen. I don't actually know for sure. Maybe I'm just making some rash assumptions here. But you guys have seen the Joe Wright directed Pride and Prejudice, right?
Oh.
With Keira Knightley? Uh-huh.
Yes.
Okay.
Many times.
I assumed this was
I've seen those pigs' testicles, believe me.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I saw them too. I saw them the way that Joe Wright intended on a Kindle Fire on an airplane.
I like that movie a lot. I'm not a fan of the ending.
Okay. So mostly what I was just curious about. So my takeaway was I'm different from you guys, I think, in that I've never seen or read Pride and Prejudice before. Anything I know about is from cultural osmosis.
Yeah.
So that was my first experience to Pride and Prejudice. And my takeaway was me basically saying, like, this was well acted. It looks nice. Everyone was good in it. It's very stately, but I didn't really care that much was my kind of takeaway. And I think that might just be a me thing. You know, like, I don't think this is a fault of the movie per se. I think this just might be one of those like, well, it didn't speak to me. And that's, you know, sometimes art just doesn't speak to you. It doesn't mean it's bad. It just means it's not for you. And so I was just curious, like, for you guys, like, one, like, this, I assume this is pretty faithful to the book.
No, it's not the most faithful.
Okay. I mean, well, that's true.
The most
I know
faithful is
the miniseries, right?
The Colin Firth one.
Right.
Which is quite good, I would suggest.
Yeah, which I assume just by dint of the fact that it's longer, it has the time to like get into like fucking everything, whereas the movie's going to condense shit.
Yeah. There are things I like about the Colin Firth one, and there are things I like about the 2005 one, and there are also things I like about other versions of Pride and Prejudice.
Okay. So would you say, like, you would say that the 2000, excuse me, gosh, you would say the 2005 one's like a good movie, though?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think it's a really good version of Pride and Prejudice.
Okay.
One thing I like that they do about that is it is very stately, but I just, the way that they do a lot of the scenes and the dialogue, there seemed to be an effort to make it more naturalistic, at least in terms of like, how would people talk to one another, which I appreciated. There was another Austin adaptation that had Sally Hawkins in it, and I can't remember which one it was, but they had a similar
Persuasion.
Approach. Persuasion.
I thought you meant Pride and Prejudice with Sally Hawkins. I was like, interesting.
No. She crushed it in Persuasion, though.
Okay. Sally Hawkins and Kieran Hines.
Yeah.
I also don't know. I really don't know Persuasion that well. Like, I'm aware it exists, and that's the extent of my knowledge, I think.
It's my favorite of the Austin stories.
If that was your first Pride and Prejudice, like you get a very different Darcy in the. Frankly, I think Matthew McFadden is like an unusual take on Darcy that I quite like.
I mean, I like it too, but that's unusual for a Darcy.
I assumed it was just by dint of the fact that so many people I know who love Pride and Prejudice are like Colin Firth is such like the epitome of what I imagine Mr. Darcy to be like. So like he seems like just by dint of the fact that Colin Firth and Matthew McFadden are two different actors. Matthew McFadden by nature has more of like a sad boy like gloomy vibe to him.
Give me my Darcy clinically depressed. Thank you very much.
And I was fine with that. Like, I assumed when watching it that I was like, this feels like it must be a different take on the character. And it seemed fine to me. It seemed like a perfectly valid interpretation.
It frankly makes Darcy more likable than he is in the books. And then maybe he even should be like at period. Like, Mr. Darcy is like the sort of gateway entry level Austin romantic hero, where it's like, as a kid, you're like, oh, that's really Mr. Darcy, so hot. And then you're like, and then by the time you reach sort of like Chad tier, you realize that Henry Tilney of Northanger Abbey is the ultimate Austin hero.
Okay.
Because he is a type B supportive wife guy.
I also don't know Northanger. It's entirely possible that I just don't really know Jane Austen that well.
Tilney, he knows muslin, and you get you a guy that knows muslin.
Get you a man who can do both.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But no, it's like very much like Mr. Darcy is supposed to be like an asshole, better or for worse. So he is in a ways a lot like sort of most K-drama male leads from like before 2000. in the sense that like it's like you're meant to be like, oh, how he's so hot because you know that he's got pain underneath that asshole exterior.
Of course.
And we'll fix him. Right. But it is very much like Jane Austen, you very much, you maybe didn't create that, but you definitely perpetuated it for next generations.
No, I do like the impression I've always gotten from Pride and Prejudice is that it I don't want to be glib or pat or sexist about this, but it does seem like it sort of influenced a certain group of women to be like, I can change the moody man. Like I can make moody man better.
I mean, that and pretty much every Bronte story, right? Like
that's true. I mean,
that's all. Sure, he's an abusive alcoholic, but look beyond that.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the Bronte we love moody men in fiction.
We're like a little more realistic about what happens when you do that.
And Bronte was. Her two other sisters, though, were like, oh, the romance.
I don't know. Which one wrote Jane Eyre? Because Jane Eyre is pretty grim.
Jane Eyre was, I believe, Charlotte?
Sure, that one's pretty grim. I don't know if that's like a happy, because she like falls for him and he is crazy and an asshole. And then she has to like run. There's all a bunch of, and then he ends up like blind and in a wheelchair or something by the end.
Yeah, that's the extent of what I know about that.
They end up like ultimately happy, but after like a lot of suffering.
Yeah, and that he has an attic wife.
Yeah, he has an attic wife. Yes. Yeah, some people have skeletons in their closet. He's got a wife.
He's got a wife in the attic.
Yeah. For sure, Mr. Darcy is. That's the big one of the big differences. Of course, you're saying at the ending.
But that's on Sunday, call me your pearl, hate.
Oh, that's just like the twee sort of epilogue. But the way that the love confession happens is very much like more done romantically and like in a modern, appealing way.
Yeah.
It's very sort of stately and formal in the book and in the Colin Firth, because it literally is like, let's all go on a walk, because that's what you do when you're about to propose to someone. So like all of them go out for a walk after like her sister has already gotten engaged to Bingley. Uh-huh. And then they sort of like conveniently leave them like behind a little bit so that Darcy can have the like this very formal conversation, like out in daylight.
Right.
Not in a romantic chance meeting on the moors or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. Not like, yeah, schlepping through the moors.
With the fog.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I have to
assume also the other thing would be just like this was just sort of a mild observation, but like Bingley's sister, she must do more in the book, I guess.
There to be like a reverse cockwalker.
Yeah.
Okay.
Basically.
That's you're right. That's kind of what I got. It just sort of felt like after she showed up in the beginning and was kind of a bitch to Rosamund Pike, she kind of just leaves the story, and then we never really get that.
She's anymore. I mean, she kind of does, like, knows. Yeah.
She does stick around a little more, but she's really like just like a second, like a side bully antagonist basically. But they don't really have much effect on the story. They're basically just there to reassert the idea that Bingley comes from an absolutely trash family that is just like full of asshole snobs.
Yes. Okay.
Her kind of like, I would say her whole character is basically like, there's maybe a feminist take where she knows that she can't achieve Darcy, but then therefore nobody else can have him. So she doesn't chase this woman away from Mr. Darcy. Because obviously he ain't going for her, but whoever gets him gets a lot of money, and that's what she wants.
Yes, that's what I want.
Yeah. So there's probably interesting things that could be done with that as a character, but that's all you get in the books, is that she's clearly like fighting off other women who get close to Darcy and being a huge bitch to them.
That tracks. I mean, and her own brother, right? Because whenever...
she would prefer that her brother also marry Rich, because then it's just, it keeps the money going.
Of course. But that was sort of my one thing that I had watched relatively recently that I figured I would just bring up here, because I figured you guys probably had some
thoughts.
Well, I'm glad you watched it.
I am too.
Now check out the Laurence Olivier version, where they used Civil War era dresses, because left over Hoop from skirts. Gone with the Wind.
Yeah. That's okay. I don't think I'll be doing that one. No.
Pretty funny.
That one, you talk about the ending to the Matthew McFadden one, not liking that one. That one is a wild ending, where his like insane aunt, who obviously like in the books and every other version of it is
Lady
like,
Catherine de Bourgh, right?
Yeah, Lady de Bourgh is like, no, you're not marrying some poor lady.
Right.
She's like a sort of like, they do like a twist ending where she shows up at the house like she does in the book, and she's like, you're not marrying my daughter. You marry him, I'll disinherit him or whatever, my son.
Yeah.
And then she leaves. And Mr. Darcy's like standing outside, and she's like, he passed the test, son, or whatever, like nephew.
Yeah, nephew.
It's like she's like a chill co-conspirator.
Boo.
I don't know why they did that.
Let Catherine de Bourgh be a villain.
It adds like nothing to the story to redeem her or have her be like a secret ally. I don't know what it is crazy.
It almost makes you wonder if like the actress who played her was like, but she can't be all bad, right? Like she has to be a little good, and the end or the audience will hate me.
I'm glad you finally dove in.
No, I am too. Yeah. Like, I'm, if nothing else, like, I think it's an important cultural thing, you know, like to at least have seen an adaptation of it, if not having actually read it or seen the TV series, you know, like it's just good to have finally done. So I'm glad I did. I don't think it's something I'll revisit, because I think it's just not for me necessarily. But like, I see why people like it. I get the appeal.
Sure.
Yeah.
All right, you guys, I'm flouncing. I'll talk to you later. Have a good chat.
Sweet. Right. Well.
Bye.
Check it out.
Bye.
Chris, why don't you... tell me about your thoughts on what you've been watching, which I think I've had a preview of, but
you sure have.
But tell me more.
I'm gonna tell you more. So I, as a young child, like middle school, I think, was when Cartoon Network started playing a lot of anime. This would have probably been in the 90s, I think.
I mean, I was watching a lot of anime too. I somehow completely skipped this one that you're about to talk about.
So as a child, I saw Sailor Moon, and it made a humongous impression on me. In my mind, it was like the femme Power Rangers that I had been wanting. It's the Power Rangers for the kid whose Pink Ranger was his favorite. Anyway, and I recently discovered, I haven't like checked in on that in a long time. Like, it's always something that has like been around for me, but I've only really known about the 90s series. And then over the past 10 years, there was like a reboot, and there's like a couple movies, which I'm going to have to hunt those down too. But anyway, the reboot is called Sailor Moon Crystal. It just looks better. The voice acting is better. I've been having a blast watching it. I love it. I love the transformation sequences. I'm almost feeling like it gives me just the right amount of conflict, and it wraps it up very quickly, which feels kind of comforting these days, because there are definitely times where I'm like, I can't take the emotional involvement of something real or serious.
Yeah.
It's silly. It's goofy. It is, though, and I didn't realize this when I was a kid, obviously, but I'm realizing it now as an adult. So I'm going to start with the fact, and we kind of talked about this before, but, all of these characters are supposed to be middle school aged, but they're drawn to look, if not like women necessarily, they're all drawn to look much more mature in their bodies. And I'm not trying to, it's not like they give them like huge, like, it's not like a TNA kind of thing, but I don't know. Like,
no,
you just have to stop
like...
and remind yourself, these are middle schoolers and they're, I don't know. It sits weird with the cosmic meant to be romance and the we were fated to be together, because like Sailor Moon and Tuxedo Mask are the reincarnations of like this king and queen from the future. And you're like, okay, but does that mean we have to watch middle schoolers make out now?
Yeah. Well, this is, well, first of all, you're dealing with like a couple. I think I don't have a whole bunch of context, but that's like a reformed weeb for like, it's true. Maybe, I don't know if you were like, would you term yourself as like a weeb as a kid? Yeah,
for sure.
I watched a fair amount of anime.
I watched a lot of Dragon Ball Z.
I watch a little bit now, but I'm like incredibly discerning about what I watch because I just got so turned off by it. But there's a couple factors. I think that like the Japanese tendency to sort of like put everything into cute mascot form.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, there are, I think there are like smaller, younger ages of consent over there.
Oh, is that true?
Younger than here, I think, but I don't know how young. But there, that might be part of it. Mm-hmm. But I think it is also this like, I don't know, for better or for worse, like there is a tendency to revert to this form for girl characters, whether it's actual high schoolers or younger than high school, or when you create a character who's some sort of immortal godlike figure, but looks like a 16-year-old.
Okay. Which also pops up in this because the season I just finished watching, I'm powering through it because it's about to leave Netflix.
Yeah.
The season I just finished watching featured Sailor Moon and Tuxedo Mask's daughter from the future, who time travels back to prevent a like terrible catastrophe.
Yep.
And she's a very young girl. For a little while, she's just like a scrappy-doo character. She's just sort of irritating or whatever. But then eventually you find out, oh no, she's like 500 years old.
You're like, no, that's the thing.
Why? And then later when she kind of gets like captured by the big bad of that season, and the big bad quote unquote turns her evil, which visually just means that she's aged up. They give her quite a noticeable bosom, chest. And it's like a low cut dress, and she's being really sexy, and you're already like, ugh. But again, I agree. This is within the tropes I was familiar with anime in general. The animes I like always seem to kind of go in this direction at times, but it's been mostly enough that I can kind of get past it a little bit.
Yeah. Well, you probably lean towards like shoujo anime, which the thing is, right? Like it's not like an automatic sign of like, this is Creeps City.
Right. Right.
But like, it's the start of it for sure. Like creepy stuff will be made out of this type of like aesthetic. But some shows, like obviously like, I doubt Sailor Moon is doing anything like, again, the time where the example you gave is like maybe an exception, but I'm sure they still pretty much mostly act like it's very PG.
Yes.
They're not like doing anything crazy, and there's no like fan service or shit like that.
Which is why. And so I usually keep my eye out for that. And in general, there's not fan service. Sometimes the transformation sequence, you can like, you almost kind of see the skirt go up, but you're not seeing anything. Like the body is not that sexualized.
Yeah.
So not only was it weird then to see her sexualized, but then she makes a play for Tuxedo Mask, but like the younger one who she knows is her father.
Yeah, that's
and
weird.
There's this whole thing where she's like, and now I have you all to myself. And like, she like mind controls him so they can make out. And you're like, and it goes uncommented upon. People are not like, hey, he's your dad.
Yeah.
It felt like someone misunderstood Back to the Future. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
A little bit.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was brief. It only lasted for like an episode, and then they kind of got past it, which I was happy about. But I was just like, why put this in here in my otherwise just goofy fun time?
Yeah.
Where people will open a brooch and a laser shoots out of it. Like, come on, let's do that instead.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So I have a question.
Yeah.
Because I missed this, but I watched a lot of shows when I was a kid. Did you not watch Cardcaptor Sakura?
Oh, I did, but not as consistently. I love Cardcaptor Sakura, though. Don't get me wrong.
That one was more my thing. I always thought it was funny that it was on at the same time as Pokemon, but like, they weren't trying to sell those cards.
No, although I think there was a brief attempt to make that happen, but the timing was not with them.
It's like a tarot deck style thing, so there's not a game that you can play with the cards, you know?
No, not really. So that's what I've been watching lately, I guess, what I have thoughts about. I also had to write about the Sex and the City sort of sequel series, and
I've seen like your review titles. fly by on Facebook and they're just like, it's just, I feel bad for you because it seems like it was a pain to get through.
Well, yeah. I mean, I kind of have a perverse joy because even just watching an odd episode of Sex and the City, if it comes on TV, I'm like enjoying it more because I'm like sort of laughing at it.
Yeah,
more
like, than, hate like watching kind of.
Exactly. Because, and I'm not trying to take away from it, you know, it was a really big deal for people at the time. I understand it has some amount of feminist value, but I think people are ridiculously kind to it these days. And I don't know. I don't think it was that great. It's a show about a sex writer who's a prude. And there's a scene that always sticks with me when Carrie Bradshaw, played by Sarah Jessica Parker, tolerates dating a bisexual man, even though she is convinced that he's just secretly gay. And then at like a party she goes to with him, she meets a character played by Alanis Morissette, and they play Spin the Bottle, and when she has to kiss Alanis Morissette, she can't do it and has to run and leave. And you're just like, this person is being paid to write about sex advice.
But like, straight girls kiss each other all the time, is my understanding. Is my understanding.
Anywho.
Not me.
What about you? What have you been watching? What are your thoughts and opinions?
I've been watching much. I mean, I have been watching Murderbot, which I've been enjoying a lot. I plowed through the books.
Sounds great.
TV show's different and good so far. It's mostly faithful. It's weird to take the quite short, compact format of a novella and shove it into, not shove it, but sort of stretch it into 10 episodes that are a half hour.
So are they doing one novella per season?
I have no idea. They might have to just quit that. But I think it would make sense to. I think like the way the novellas are, they're adding a lot of stuff in the first one. And a lot of the stuff they're adding is to give more context to people who are not familiar with the world.
Got it.
Is good. In 2 and 3, the main human cast are mostly absent. And therefore, it would be a good opportunity to add what the fuck they are doing, because the books are written from Murderbot's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not there. It's on its own adventure.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't know what the humans are doing. So the TV show would then have seasons 2 and 3 filler time to like, they're not doing nothing. Stuff happens.
Right.
So they could, you know, we could finally see what they're doing, which would be fun.
Something I've heard that I wanted to hear your thoughts on about Murderbot. I read a thing recently that was talking about how its episodes are very short.
Yeah, a lot of people say, I mean, they're probably on par with like if Disney Plus was doing like a half hour show where like
it
shows up as like 35 minutes, but it's like 24 and then like it's a lot of credits.
Right.
Kind of a thing.
Right.
The runtime. And the point I was making before we got distracted, like the whole thing with stretching out into episodes, means that what happens is that you keep ending episodes at these very critical junctures. I think that helps them feel short,
mm-hmm.
because you're ending like every episode kind of ends in a cliffhanger.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently the showrunners at an interview said this was deliberate, that they wanted it to feel like the serial TV's episodes that Murderbot watches.
I like that.
Which is like an interesting choice. I can see that. It is like, I don't mind the format as much, but it does make it hard for me personally. I also struggle with like, I'm generally okay with week to week, but I do struggle with the weight a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes the weight a little harder, but you know, I don't really mind. I'm not really like, I don't know that would call the episode length too short, because I still feel like we're still going to get all the content and more that the book is going to give us by the time 10 episodes are up.
Right.
I think we didn't need 10 episodes, but the fact that we have 10, none of it feels like filler so far, if that makes sense.
I am glad to hear that they're at least staying within the half hour format, more or less.
Yeah.
Because I feel like if it were 10 hour long episodes, that would be mega stretch.
Oh, no, that
right?
would be way too much. 100%. But yeah, that's what I'm watching.
Mm-hmm.
And mostly right now, in between that, I've been chowing down a new game. It is called Clair Obscur.
Yeah, Clair Obscur Expedition 33.
Everyone, a lot of hype.
It's getting rave reviews.
And it's kind of like just a good success story in general, because it is a game made by a bunch of ex-Ubisoft directors, mm-hmm. and other developers who are let go, or you know, from these big AAA companies that are constantly trying to cut employees and costs, and like AAA games are increasingly incurring like massive amounts of cost to make, mm-hmm. and a lot of bloat in the games themselves. and price points are increasing resultingly. And so you have this game that's made by like a relatively like ragtag group of developers, made on a far less like of a, you know, budget constraint. Like there's like a lot, you know, a lot less stuff than what the AAA companies have.
So would you say this is
like a professional AAA game? No. This is like, this game is incredibly polished. It's not like the best. Like it's, you know, it's probably not like, you know, as good as, I don't know, like The Witcher 4 looks pretty intense in the latest trailer I saw. But like, it looks beautiful. Like the game looks beautiful. The voice acting is very professional. I mean, they got names like Charlie Cox, and they got Ben Starr and also a lot of others, and recognizable people. The story is bananas. Overall, yeah, visuals great. Mechanics are amazing. Aside from some frustrations, which I will get into, which are not just minor. I wouldn't have shared them.
I'm very fond of how you described it to the game to me once as it's a JRPG wearing a Western RPG like shell, basically.
It is. Yeah, it is like it's definitely like an RPG in spirit, but it looks like very Western in aesthetic and everything else. So like overarching thing plot, it's like a Belle Epoque styled fantasy world that is not Earth. Seemingly only one city that anyone ever talks about. Presumably there were other cities, I don't know, but they talk about the continent and like the city of Lumiere as if that was like it or whatever,
which is also a very clear French reference, because Paris is also called the city of light.
Yeah, well, Lumiere. There's also like an Eiffel Tower that's in the game that's like not the Eiffel Tower, but it looks a whole lot like it. There's a lot of stuff. It's, you know, it's just fun. It's meant to be fun. But yeah, so in the fantasy world of the game, like 67 years before the game starts, there was something called the Fracture, an event in which, I don't know, the continent exploded or something because like a monolith came out, and on the monolith was this giant woman, pale woman with like long hair called the Paintress. And she painted a number on the monolith, and it was 100. And so, like, the city that you're from is, like, a remnant of the city that got sort of literally, like, exploded and flung across the ocean so that it's an island now. The rest of the city was, like, in ruins, and people sort of died out on the continent. And they didn't know what the number meant. And then a year later, it goes to 99, and nobody knew what the number meant until eventually it got to an age where a number where people of that age were alive. And then all of the people of that age, when she changed the number, died. So like, and they sort of turn into flower petals and just disappear. Like they sort of get like Thanos snapped. So there's this concept of like the people of Lumiere go on expeditions. And the first one was like the zero with expedition. And then after that, it's like the number that you're the year that's painted on it. The early ones were apparently like search and rescue. They were just like looking to find survivors. But after they were aware of what the Paintress is and or what she does, which seemingly is paint this number that makes all of the people of that age die, the goal of the expeditions were to try to coax stop the Paintress somehow.
Makes sense.
And you are in the year where she's painted the number 33. So you're all people, I think that you're 32, and therefore in a year she'll paint 32 and then you'll die.
So is it always counting down? Like it started at 100?
Yeah, and then it's sort of this thing where 99. You're aging up and she's counting down. So like you meet in the middle and die. But I don't know. So everyone in the expedition has to be that age or younger. And there are, in fact, nobody left on this island except people who were under 33, basically. And so this gets into like my a little bit of a criticism. And maybe this is like an old problem with JRPGs and seeing it done in such like an unexpected aesthetic. Mm-hmm. I'm not like used to that. Or maybe there's also a possibility that this is generally why I prefer Western RPGs to JRPGs, where because of that distance, situations arise where like you get characters or you start playing as characters and you're like, I don't know what your deal is. Walking around as you. I don't know what your deal is, man. You're not telling me everything. And I don't get to know that as the player. I don't even get to know what the fuck is going on in this world with, even though you were born here and you should know. And there's like sort of camp scenes where you, as the character that, again, ostensibly you're walking around in and therefore controlling, and therefore are you supposed to put yourself in that character? I don't know. And you're talking to other characters and like building bonds, and you're like, am I supposed to be like rooting for this? Am I just sort of watching these two people talk and being like, what a nice cutscene? Or am I like trying to judge what I should say to this person as the character or as me? Like, you're given character the dialogue options as this guy, and I'm like, I don't know what is more like this character to say. I don't know. I don't know enough about this character. So
it's also difficult to make choices in alignment with him if you actually don't know who he is.
Correct. It's like a kind of like, it's a bit of a a dissonance in my brain of like what I'm supposed to be doing or how I'm supposed to be sort of like, I guess, RPing or playing the game in certain ways. Because maybe I default to that sort of more Western thing of like, put myself in the character. I don't have, it doesn't have to be a self-insert, but if it isn't, then I have to know enough about this character to
make informed choices.
Make what the decision that they would make.
Mm-hmm.
So other than that, I will say the mechanics are really satisfying. It is turn-based RPG with like every character has a thing. You learn their thing and then you have to get good at that thing. Like one character has like a fucking wheel that has different colors on it, and the colors make certain skills work better. And then
that's cool.
The wheel advances by how many skill points it costs to use the current skill.
Okay.
So like you have to kind of like strategize how the wheel spins or how much you want the wheel to spin for your next move. Maybe if you want to boost that attack next time.
Right.
There's a character who has like a perfection rank where the more he doesn't get hit and the more he parries and shit, he gains perfection. And then if you get hit, you get lower down a rank. And then certain perfection ranks give you boosts to, again, certain abilities. It's a lot of that. So everything is, in that respect, is very fun. And there's, you can play it chill or you can play it really deep. And there's a million different things to assign to characters called like luminas that, again, give you like different passive boosts, and you can get really meta with it if you want, or you don't have to, you can just slap on the same 20 you do on everyone and call it a day. So yeah, there's a lot of fun stuff in this game. I would definitely recommend playing it at some point, and I don't want to spoil too much of what I've learned about the plot since then.
I was going to say, I'm definitely going to give it a play. Yeah. I'm still just finishing up Baldur's Gate.
Yeah. Anyway, I think it's probably time we should probably wrap this one up. All right, guys, come back at us in 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
About the Singing Detective.
And we're going to sing about the Talking Detective.
We're going to sing about the Talking Detective, and we're going to talk about the Singing Detective.
Exactly.
Yeah.
All right. Well, all right. We're just going to two-voice by it out.
Yeah, yeah. Bye.